Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi there, I'm Brian Abana, and you're listening to the Mall Over Podcast.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to this week's Mall Over Podcast, the only rugby podcast that gives all the news, views, and opinion on the weekend's rugby action, all with a West Country accent. You can find us on Twitter. We are at Mall Over Podcast, Mall Over Rugby Podcast on Facebook, and you can find all of our podcasts on Anchor and Apple Pods and lots of other podcast sites. This week, I am joined by the Lensman. How you doing, Doug? And that was glorious. Was that duck and dolphin? Why you've just burped down a microphone?
I'm all right. Yeah,
good. Just for the record, listeners, Doug, if you didn't realise already, is an absolutely pretentious twat. I'm also joined by the housewife's favourite, who enjoyed an Aldi fish cake for dinner. Phil, welcome.
Hi.
And you can't see him, but I can, and he looks like he wants me to paint him like one of his French girls. The nicest man in Cornish Rugby Podcasting, Ben Eustace. Welcome, Ben.
Disclaimer, I do not have any French girls.
Well, yeah, or boys.
Yeah, captive or otherwise.
Nice. And we're going to have a chat about this week's rugby. There's not much going on next weekend. Obviously, if anybody actually cares about this European competition, especially now that the ECPR have announced that they're going to make all sorts of changes to squads to allow COVID regulations. And did you hear that every game, if it can't go ahead, the club will have to forfeit instead of it being rearranged, direct forfeit, and unlucky. So
what's the forfeit?
The forfeit is
like a dirty pint.
Yeah, dirty pint. You have to run around the pitch in your pants, shouting, "We are riddled with COVID."
Don't talk about COVID, Rush. You'll cost us listeners again.
I'm not, but what they have to do whilst they're running around the pitch in only their pants is wear a mask.
Where?
Over their ghoulies.
Where do they have to wear a mask?
The mask has to be worn around their genitals.
It has to work its way around the squad, going genitals to face to genitals to face.
Genital mask. Nice. I mean, that'll stop the spread of certain infections anyway.
Might increase the spread of others, but yeah.
Wow. You know, life in it.
Yeah.
Right. Should we talk about some rugby? We were going to do a money line segment looking ahead till next week, but as I've already mentioned, that nobody really cares about Europe. So we're going to look back, starting with the Friday night game at King's Home, where it still entirely baffles me, that Gloucester pitch. I can't get my head around it. I can't get my head around the reasoning for it. I can't get my head around why a team with such, historically decent home record. Like, you know, Gloucester and Kingsham was always such a fearsome place to go, and they used to tie teams down with hard, you know, rugby, a lot of Friday night games at Kingsham in the wet. And now they, I mean, they seem to kind of made it easier for teams to visit, in my view. Obviously, it didn't work that way Friday night, but they kind of taken away a little bit of their home edge. I don't know what you think about that, Phil.
Yeah, totally agree. I think it was you that said it, Russ, actually, on Friday, that if this was back on the old King's home pitch, Bristol would have been out of the game probably by half time. Don't let him take credit for that. Sorry, Dougie. if you look at somebody with the skill and the running quality of Charles Peartow, is he going to be happier on a pristine fake grass pitch or running through a bog at Kingsholm and getting smashed by eight big heavy guys? Well, the reality is that that switch to an artificial pitch is not really likely to do Gloucester many favours, other than the fact that they have got a bit of speed out back. But, I mean, Lloyd Evans was relatively uninspiring at fullback.
Mate, you say that, and you're entirely correct. But for about 15 minutes, Ugo and Ben Kay literally circle wanked over Lloyd Evans playing at fullback when I can't remember ever seeing him play fullback. And Ugo was like, oh, they just make such a good move. He's such a great decision maker at fullback. He's this, he's that. And I'm like,
well, if you listen to Ugo and Ben Kay and Austin Healy and Lawrence Dallaglio, you can either convince yourself that you know fuck all about rugby, or actually you know quite a lot, and the people who are professionals know fuck all about rugby, because they just talk shit all the time. And half the time they're talking just for the sake of talking. They're not contributing to anything. But anyway, even going back to the pitch issue, I mean, they've got two of the hardest running centres in the Premiership. They've got Atkinson and Harris there, and they're playing on an artificial pitch. They want mud and grass under their feet. I mean, Harris, the guy must be hard as nails. The amount he was, his knees must have been skinned on that pitch, and he just keeps going through it again and again and again. But I mean, we've been relatively critical of Gloucester over the last two or three years. It's the first time I've seen them play this season, and I was quite impressed by them. They seem to play rugby in the right kind of ways for the players that they've got. I think Hastings does a pretty good job of controlling it.
He still looks ill.
He does.
Not having it. And what was he wearing on his fingers? Somebody talk me through that.
It was it Goromaru, the Japan fullback, had fingers like that when they came over for the World Cup in 2013.
You know what he reminded me of? And I don't know whether he still listens, but a good friend of mine, Tyrone. Ben, you'll remember Tyrone.
Your getaway driver.
No, he wasn't. He is not a getaway driver. He's a mechanic. No,
well, he drives a steam engine, so yeah, he's not getting very far.
But he always used to. Well, he always would have. He used to use electrical tape as plasters because he would have cuts and bruises and snags all over his hands from working in the engines, and like the ends of his fingers would just literally be taped up with electrical tape. And that's what it reminded me of. Like Adam Hastings had electrical tape on the end of his fingers. And I can only think it was like, obviously not that, but it was just pointless. It seemed pointless to me.
Yeah, you're right. Back to the rugby though. I thought the Gloucester back row were good. I thought Ackerman was decent. Probably not the man of the match for me. I thought Ludlow should have been man of the match. I thought Morgan
criminally underrated Lewis Ludlow.
I think Morgan did some great carrying in the first half, and Geordie Reid was a bit abrasive and a bit more groundwork in the second half. And the back row played pretty well there, and they look like they don't look like a top four team, but they look like a team that should be in the top half quite comfortably come the end of the season. Gloucester. I still don't get the Singleton thing. I think he's a particularly average hooker. I didn't see him do much other than the technical stuff that he should be doing, which, let's be honest, some hookers are not particularly good at, and he did the technical stuff right. But other than that, I didn't see much of him.
Yeah.
Valrapava Ruskin absolutely crucified Afoa a couple of times. And Gutovtsev got the better of Woolmore as well.
What's going on at Bristol, Doug, do you think? I mean, they've won three games this season. They've beaten Bath, beaten London Irish, beaten Worcester.
I think they've stood still and other clubs have moved forward. They haven't really added anyone to that squad of consequence since last year, have they? So while they were very much one of the dominant sides last year, the teams around them have moved forward and they've stood still. So I just think it's caught up with them, and they seem to only know how to play one way. And the Premiership is fast becoming a game of you've got to be able to compete at the scrums and you've got to be able to finish chances. I mean, I guess that's all rugby, but they don't seem to be able to. Last season they were finishing everything they got. This season they seem to be just slightly off, and they are getting pumped in every single game I see them play at scrum time. So doesn't lend itself. I also think Callum Sheedy's dipped in form substantially, and he was obviously a lot of the reason why they were sort of playing with so much confidence last year.
He went a bit. Can I disagree? Into the rabbit in the headlights.
Can time. I disagree with that? I think Callum Sheedy rode the crest of a wave last season in a Bath pack that got a lot of front
foot
support. Yeah, no. No, you think? Is it? I think. Anyway, I think what I'm going to say is I think Callum Sheedy is average at best. And
yeah, but last year he absolutely wasn't. He was phenomenal.
I don't think he was phenomenal. I think he did simple things with phenomenal people playing better outside him. I think Bristol arguably played better when Malins was in at 10. And
yeah, they're definitely Malins didn't play 10 for Bristol.
Yeah, he did. He played at least two or three games while Sheedy was at in the Six Nations with Wales. And
are you sure? I'm pretty sure, yeah. Lloyd played in those games.
Nope, not always.
Show me a stat. Show me somewhere where he played at 10.
Okay, I will. Okay. Carry on.
Ben L as well. They lost Ben L. So, in fact, you could argue that they've gone, rather than standing still, they've actually gone backwards because their squad's less good than it was this time last year. It's not really a surprise because they seem to, they're trying to, you know, emulate mid-2000s Real Madrid. Don't think that really works in rugby.
Right, but you guys need to carry on because I'm desperately searching for Max Mellins at fly half.
Do they miss
Pietau as well? Siali Pietau as that physical presence at 12. I think they do.
Yeah, I'd not really considered him, mate, to be honest. He played pretty much every game, didn't he, last year?
Yeah.
I was going to say was what Doug talked himself into saying is that without the two Saracens players that have gone from loan, plus the fact I think this is the first time Rodrada's played all season, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, first half of rugby. And so, did you see the immediate impact?
But you know, if you're looking for a centre to make life of a fly half easier, that's probably one of the first names on your team sheet because he is hard running and he's creative. So, you know, you're missing two semi-regular England starters and one of the best players in the world. The team probably has gone backwards a little bit. If you actually look at that team, if you take Pietau and Luatua out of that team, it's actually not that inspiring at all. it's very mid-table looking. Whereas even that Gloucester team probably has a little bit more star power in it.
Yeah, I mean, look at where they came undone in this game. Henry Purdy, who was playing out of his skin last year, was found out a couple of times. Sinclair was pumped in the scrum. Afoa, who this time last year everyone was standing around and jacking off.
He's 78.
Yeah, yeah. Where's Alokin gone? He was scoring tries for fun last year. Is it Alokin, the ex-army guy?
Adi Alokin.
Yeah. Morahan. He was scoring tries all over the place. There's a Dave Atwood. Where's Atwood? Is he injured?
Just on the John Afoa thing, he last played international rugby 10 years ago. That shows how old he is. Atwood played, came off after 60 minutes. He's 38, John Afoa. And I don't care who you are, you're not as good at 38 as you are at 37 or 36. Yeah.
I do think that Gloucester are rounding off into quite a decent side as well. I think there's a bit of a homogenisation of the Premiership at the moment, where every team is sort of retreating back to the mean. I don't think there's any standout teams. Like, Leicester are playing really well, but they're right. I think they are riding the crest of a wave. I think it'll be interesting to see if they do lose a couple of games. I mean, they're not going to go the whole season unbeaten, but they haven't lost. And like Borthwick said, they've forgotten how to lose, and it'll be interesting to see how they react to getting beaten, because it will happen. From what I saw yesterday, they are not a team that anyone should play thinking that they can't beat. I know they pumped Saints, but as a Saints fan, I don't think I'm as worried about playing them in the playoffs as I would be about playing Saracens or Exeter.
No, I think you're probably right. Although, yeah, I think you are probably right that they're a team that are playing well at the moment.
They're also a team that aren't suffering injuries. Correct. Every other team suffered injuries. That Leicester team's pretty much their first choice 15, which gets you a long way. Anyone? Bueller?
He's still looking, isn't he?
Yeah.
you look at and it can't be understated. I'm not the biggest George Ford fan, but it can't be understated the impact of having him there for 26 games this season, or 24 games, whatever it is, when everyone else around them are losing their key men. You know, it's only, you look at Saracens are going to lose their 10, Saints lose their 10, Bristol will probably lose their 10, Exeter don't, but that's by the by. Quins will lose their 10.
I think you hit on a good point there, though, Doug, in that excluding Saracens, who still probably, despite some comments to the contrary, still probably have pretty good squad depth there, despite some players leaving permanently and some players not being available. The rest of the teams that are doing pretty well, so your Leicesters, your Saints, Quins, Gloucester to some degree, they've had a reasonable amount of stability in the squad throughout the 9 games that they've had so far. They probably haven't suffered as many key injuries, and they probably aren't as affected as other teams by players having been away a reasonable amount for autumn internationals or off the back of the Lions tour or things like that. Although somebody will come up with a stat that will prove me wrong.
Well, it won't be Russ, judging by his inability to find whether or not... Max
Malin's played at 10 for Bristol against Exeter last season.
Great. But an Irish as well, they're seventh. They're probably overperforming slightly, compared with expectations. They got a very stable squad and they wouldn't have lost many players or gained many players throughout various stages. Whereas some of the other teams, well, if you look at the bottom three, they're all teams that have gone backwards compared with last season.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are Irish underperforming? I'm not sure they are. I think
overperforming.
I'm not sure they are overperforming. If anything, I'd say they're underperforming. They're that side.
I don't think many people would have put Irish as a top half team at the start of the season.
I think I would have. I'm not sure that. I think they suffer from a bit of an image problem in that I'm yet to understand how someone like Hassel Collins or Tom Parton or Ben Loader haven't been given opportunities at a higher level. That back three is probably one of the most frightening back threes in the country. We've got a really decent front row. They've got probably one of the best tens in the world that's not playing international rugby for reasons that
we should not go into,
rightly or wrongly. And they've only, you know,
and they're well coached as well.
They've drawn three games this season, which I think
that's madness in itself, isn't it?
Yeah. If they, you know, turn two of those into wins, you know, and they're in,
third.
They're in the top four, comfortably in the top four.
They're in third if you turn two of those into wins.
So, not many
people would have picked them as a top four side at the start of the season.
No, I think the league pretty much is. There's two divisions basically. I think London Irish to Leicester, any one of those teams can beat any one of those teams, and then maybe Newcastle sort of sit with a foot in either side, and then from Wasps down. Although with Sale, it's a bit of a, I don't got my views on that, but with those teams, they kind of seem a bit out of it at the moment. Something's going on at Sale, which I can't put my finger on, but.
But you've got some suspicions.
Well, maybe he's not the messiah that he thought he was and that he tells everyone he is.
Whenever has a messiah been the messiah that they've made out themselves to be?
Russ?
Yeah. He's not the messiah.
I think on that point, I think he was sort of doomed to failure. There's just a little bit of he's gone there thinking that he's going to be the man. There's a little bit of hubris. And he came from a system that has been the same for nearly a decade. And I'm not sure he's got too many ideas about how to sort it out. Because he only knows one way. He hasn't really had a proper rugby education, has he? When you look at someone like Borthwick, who's been all over the world, Chris Boyd's coached in different countries and different styles of rugby, that whole Harlequins coaching staff.
You could argue Rob Baxter sits in that Sanderson boat, though, could you?
Yeah, but he was the architect. He wasn't the builder, was he?
You know, he was the organ grinder, not the monkey, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, he came up with the system, whereas Sanderson was just part of a big machine.
It's interesting when you look at Kelly Bratt, like they've just literally removed Alex Sanderson and plugged in Kelly Brown, who's just got better eyebrows.
Yeah, and less nauseating pitchside interviews.
Fair. Any more on Bristol and Gloucester? I know we've divulged straight, well, all over the place from there. But before we go on to what was the game of Saturday, Doug, you were
just one thing. Where does Lewis Ludlow sit in I can never remember. He's an open side, isn't he?
The hierarchy of English open.
Yeah, where does he sit in that ranking?
He'll be for me. I'd put him pretty high up there, but I don't think he'd fit anywhere near Eddie Jones's criteria.
Tom Curry, Courtney Laws, Itoje.
Laws and Itoje are sixes if they play back row.
Jones, or
Curry can play eight, but yeah, it's Underhill's ahead of him. That's the bottom line.
And Curry.
And if Underhill's injured, they'll play Curry at seven and Laws at six. So he's probably third or fourth down that list.
But if you look at recent history, Lewis Ludlam has been in front of him.
Yeah, he keeps looking at Ludlam and then...
And would Tom Willis be away. Jack Willis and Tom Willis?
Jack would be. I mean, I think if Tom Willis was going to get picked, he might have been picked by now. The amount of work he gets through for Wasps, I think he's pretty decent. And you could argue that, you know, when we were looking for a number eight, when we were discussing Don Brandt and Simmons in that number eight jersey, Tom Willis, you know, is it slightly criminal that he's been completely overlooked for that? Or is he injured? I don't know. But, you know, the amount of points he gets through and the amount of work he gets through for Wasps is unbelievable. So, you know, he could be an eight.
It's just a bad time to be an English back row player, isn't it? Because I don't think we've ever been stronger in that position. And there's going to be some truly remarkable players that never get recognition at international level.
Yeah. And we'll have to wait and see when Jack Willis comes back, what, you know, where he fits into that England makeup.
It's all right, because Lewis Ludlam's great grandparents are from Samoa, so he'll be changing his allegiance soon anyway.
Who's that?
Lewis Ludlow.
Yeah. I was going to say, is he frantically searching for any kind of distant relative that was Welsh or Scottish?
Do you not think there's quite a big gap between Underhill and Curry and the others, though?
No, yeah. I really don't. I've watched a lot of Lewis Ludlam and Ludlow, and I don't think there is a massive gap.
I just think he's a different type of player from them. I think he does what he does better than the other two, but I think the other two are probably more rounded back row players that fit in the current England setup. I think he's going to be penalised as a result of the way that he plays rugby. But I'll tell you what, if I was playing six, I'd rather have him at seven than either of the other two, because he will make your life so much easier.
He's a line-out jumper as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think he's... just a really fantastic all-round player. And if he can't start, he should at least be on the bench or even in the squad. He's not even making the squads at the moment, is he?
No. He played in those two internationals in the summer, didn't he?
Well, he captained one of them.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Yeah. Became the fifth player in history to captain England on debut.
Wow, there you go.
That's how you do research, Russ. Do it quick.
How many weeks have you been sitting on that stat?
About 32 seconds.
Incredible. Well done. Saturday then, Doug, you were at wherever Northampton play their games now.
The Sim Stadium at Franklin's Gardens.
The Sim Stadium at Franklin's Gardens.
Yeah.
Fucking rubbish. and they sort of comprehensively beat Bath. I mean, from the highlights that I watched, you know, the issues Bath have defensively were pretty well exposed. I mean, it was almost optional defence at times, wasn't it?
I don't think it can be understated. And I think it's been alluded to that Bath lost McNally in the warm-up. Then they lost Ben Spencer after 5 minutes and Cipriani after 20. So losing, I'd say McNally is up there as one of their most important players at the moment. Losing your 9 and 10, not ideal. And being 14-0 down after 5 minutes, also not ideal. So it was pretty toothless, I'll be honest. They were... But I think part of that was the fact that Saints came out of the blocks absolutely firing. And if you've already lost eight games and you go 14-0 down after 5 minutes, you're not going to have a lot of energy left, are you? I don't think you're going to really
just mail it in for the next.
Yeah, 65 yeah, mail minutes. It in, move on to the next one.
I don't think that Bath team have had a lot of fight and heart in them for a couple of years though. Because when things start going wrong, they implode. I think it's a cultural issue in that club.
We've said it before, and we'll say it again. I'm sure. Maybe even next year when one of these championship teams gets promoted. But Bath are currently London Welsh bad.
Yeah.
They are getting pumped every week. They're averaging, 15 points a game? Conceding nearly 30 a game? That's pretty bad, Ben. How do you feel about that?
I was going to say, how do you feel about that as a Bath fan?
Well, a lot better than I would if there was relegation.
Oh God, I would have gone to roughly 20 Bath games at the Rec if they were playing Amps Hill there and all those
things. It's just not working, is it? There's enough good players to be competitive because as you said earlier, most of the teams are sort of regressing to the same standard. And if Bath played at their best, they'd be at that standard, but they're just poor. Like the front five just seems to get battered every week.
Which is incredible considering that front five is who they are. You know, yeah. Lewis Boyce is an ex-England under-20s player. Will Stewart's a current England international.
Abano.
Who's their hooker on Saturday, Ben?
Dunn.
He's an England international, right?
Yeah.
He's a liability.
Newell's.
Yeah.
And you've got, you know, that team should not be getting pumped. And it has to be a messaging issue, right? It has to be... You can't lose. You can't be conceding twice as many points as you're scoring and looking this disheveled and unorganized with the talent that they've got available, unless there's a messaging issue that the players just aren't, they're not responding to their coaching, you know?
I think we touched on it earlier in that Saracens play in a certain way and they play in a way that's so distinctive that they can plug in a new coach, as someone said earlier. That's how Saracens play. And they've gone down, come back. They've got some of the same players and some different players, but they still play roughly the same style that they played 4 or 5 years ago. And Exeter are the same. They've got an identity that they play. And at one stage, a season or two ago, Leicester were almost as bad as this Bath team. But they've gone back to closer to their sort of horrible phrase, but rugby DNA. And become successful again. And it's almost like Bath don't have a plan. In the early stages of Hooper, they were trying to tough it up front and beat people up. But they seem to have gone away from that. But are they trying to run a Bristol-style attack? No, they're not really either. So what is it that they're trying to do? Mears a decent player. Ajomo's a decent player. De Glanville's really good, but are they just doing individual things more than they're doing linked Bailey's, up play? I think that's probably true.
Bailey's a decent player. Bailey's as been well. Good.
I think it didn't help that they had Max Ajomo playing his first ever game at 10 after Cipriani went off.
I mean, that
suggests that they haven't got a plan
this year either.
Yeah, what? Go on, Ben.
I just say they haven't had a lot of Spencer this year either, but, you know, it just seems a bit rudderless.
But
so
you got Cipriani playing 10, but no legitimate 10 cover on the bench. It doesn't make any sense. Someone's picking that team. Now, it's either injuries or whatever that they haven't got anyone that can do that job. And that's nothing against Max Ajomo, who's been, I think he's been one of the shining lights of Bath coming into the side, playing 12. I think he's been really good. But he's not a 10.
No. And yeah, you're right. It's exactly what we were talking about. There doesn't seem to be a lot of planning going on. Now, I don't actually know if Bailey is injured or not. But, even if he is, most teams have got a third fly half.
Well, yeah, exactly.
But, you know,
we're just looking you know, people throwing in the like Harvey Skinner for Exeter has played a lot of games this season. Yeah. There's, the lad at Charlie Atkinson at Wasps before he got injured. There's a couple out there and they're just kind of throwing them in. Like, you've almost got to do it, haven't you?
Are we too far gone in this season now, Ben, to make a change and it reasonably affect? And is there actually any kind of desire to change and affect this season, or is this season now a write-off?
I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I mean, the season's a write-off anyway. So if you're going to make a change, you probably want to make it now and try and if you can bring in someone now, they can identify types of players they want to sign. Whereas if you leave it to the summer, it's too late. You can also, you know, bring your own style to the team. And it doesn't matter what that style is, but they need to know what it is. So you can get pumped by 40 points playing like this, or you can get pumped by 40 points learning a new system. Well, it's got to be better to be learning the system. So if you're going to make a change, make it soon.
And you've got that 18 months to prepare to head into a pre-season next season rather than end of the season.
Yeah, I mean,
get a new coach, then prepare.
I mean, we don't know what's going on. They might have already identified someone. They might have them lined up even, and they might tell them who they want to sign, but they're not going to be able to impose how they're actually going to play on whether while the coach that's in place is in place. But it, yeah, I mean, Doug's not wrong. It is looking London Welsh bad, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you feel like it's now a point of pride for Dyson and Bruce Craig to not get rid of because they'd obviously groomed him from he was being spoken about as being the DOR, the next Bath DOR, 2 years before he retired, right?
Yeah, it's almost like it's sort of their own.
It's like an indictment of their brilliance because they're both successful businessmen, aren't they? Are they holding on to this because they don't like being wrong?
It's almost like an old school football club. You know, the ones you read about from the 70s that were sort of run by the guy that had the sort of five local car dealerships and that is run as almost their own sort of fiefdom. And it's got that feel to it. Like Bruce Craig has quite a lot of input and, you know, stuff seems to be done his way. So if Hooper's his man, then perhaps that is a reason that they're persevering with him. But at the same time, no one's going to be putting that much money into a club and having so little return on it. So they've got to be running out of patience soon, surely.
Well, I
mean, they're playing
so.
Leinster this weekend.
I mean, when was the last time 100 points was put on a team in the Champions Cup?
Fucking hell. Well, Saints have had a few goes at it.
Did you see the retweet I did yesterday? Someone had just put next Leinster v Bath, and they put the you know, the African funeral gif.
Just go there, boys. Get the vase out and pull your shorts down.
I'll be honest. I don't think Bath need to look at anything personnel-wise. I think it's purely comes down to coaching and mental preparation. I think something is up when you've got a team absolutely jam-packed full of players of international quality, and as soon as they go 20 points down, they totally capitulate every game. Like, if you look at their results, they've either lost by ignoring the Sale game, they've either lost by kind of 5 to 10 points or they've lost by 40 plus points. And that has to be a mental thing. Those players are not bad enough that they should ever lose by 40 points.
But they played pretty well against Bristol.
Which Flatman was a while tweeted ago.
Flatman tweeted though yesterday, which I agreed with at the time, the games where they have been competitive, they've shot themselves in the foot by taking their best players off. You know,
So they lost by five points.
It's kind of a, you know, used to do that. And if you go back to our earlier podcast, you'll hear me complaining about that, about Malander. It was like, it didn't matter
systematic how well substitutions. Someone was playing
at 60 minutes. You know, at 60 minutes, Myler would come off and we would put on, I don't know, any one of those journeyman fucking fly-offs that we had, you know, who was it? Ryan Lamb or the Shane Geraghty, or we'd put on a centre at 10 because Myler was only playing 60 minutes that week, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the Bristol game.
If Malander was still there, guaranteed they'd have signed Billy 12-3 as by now.
No danger of that not being the case. The other one we'd have definitely... Who's the other one we'd definitely have signed? Rory... No, the Leicester one.
Freddie Burns.
Oh, God, he would have been a Saints player under Malander.
Yeah, definitely. And then been replaced by his brother Billy after a while.
Yeah.
Right, let's move on. Exeter versus Saracens. The kind of the clash everyone's been waiting for, wasn't it? And it just so happened that Exeter, you know, had a load of players back from injury. Saracens had a few players back from injury, the likes of Alex Good, and no, not Alex Good, the likes of Elliot Daly, and Ben, who was the other one that came back from injury? I might have just been.
Let's just wait 5 minutes while Russ finds out.
Fuck off, not bad. but it absolutely lived up to all the hype. I thought it was an absolutely fascinating game. I'll directly compare this to the game on Sunday for Leicester versus Quins. Whilst it lacked any real quality, like real quality for 80 minutes, what it made up for was intrigue and passion, and that the fact that it was always kind of it boiling point, it was always simmering. Whereas Quins versus Leicester just kind of lacked any real quality, and it was just a little bit meh. What do you make? There's a lot's been made of Luke Pearce of this. Did he not give the players enough respect by man managing them when he just marched Atoji and then Billy Villapola back for 20 meters when they back chatted him? And I'm, you know, a lot of back chat, a lot of non-captain chatter to the referee goes on a lot in rugby nowadays. Maybe not even 5 years ago, nobody could speak to the referee other than the captain. You couldn't even, don't even approach him because I'm not going to talk to you. I'm going to talk to your captain and that's it. And now it's all very pally-pally. It's all very first name terms. Not now, Danny. You know, leave it there, Mako. You know, all of this, you know, first name terms, which I find unnecessary. Almost unprofessional. I think that it should be kept to a drawn line. I'm all for a bit of mutual respect, but I think using first names, having a laugh and a joke is not the way to go. And I think that players have started to take advantage of that. So when I saw Luke Pearce march Saracens back 20 metres, I thought it was fantastic. And I think it should happen a lot more because it would stamp out a load of the shit that goes on at the moment. And Luke Pearce, and I think, Doug, you'll agree, you said before we come on, is comfortably the best referee in the Premiership at the moment.
Oh, I think so, yeah, without a doubt.
And, you know, that's... that's including Barnsley, as far as I'm concerned. I think on current form, and I use Barnsley specifically there as a noun to prove a point. So
what you say is right though.
The Lebra ref,
the referees and how the referees referee the game determines how the players play. And to some degree, it's always been that way, but it's even more that way in the era of professionalisation. And the clubs will have somebody analysing how the referees referee the game so that they know what they can do and what they can't do. And it's a classic Eddie Jones tactic early when in his England career to give away a penalty in the first 5 minutes to find out where that line is drawn for giving away a penalty. If you look at putting the ball in straight in the scrums, until it gets penalised, that's never going to change. They will always put the ball just, in crooked because nobody ever gets pinged for it.
Well, they do that, Phil, because everyone's so shit scared of people getting injured at a scrum. I mean, I don't know how often people have actually been injured at scrums at rugby in the last 100 years. Yes, twice. There have been some serious injuries in all facets of rugby. But they want out of that scrum, all the referees want is the ball out of it as soon as possible so they don't have to make a fucking decision. And when they do make a decision, it's a guess.
But it's the same for like every penalty that gets kicked to touch. The kicker starts his run up where the penalty's given and then takes another 3 or 4 yards and pinches that and gets away with it. The hookers, they stand on the mark and then they take a step towards their team, so they're starting, not throwing them in straight. The only way things like that ever change is if they get penalised. So, you know what? If you want to stop back chat to the refs, and I think we do want to stop back chats to the ref, if you're not the captain, the only thing that you should be allowed to say is, excuse me, sir, what was that for? Then, ping them, push them back 10 yards, push them back another 10 yards. I can pretty much guarantee that Billy and Itoje showed a lot more respect after that point than they were before it.
Quite possibly. We had a bit of correspondence from Twitter. It's Andrew Riley is a Saracens fan. He said, Exeter versus Saracens, not arguing the result, and the team able to score tries normally win the game. But even though Saracens served it on a plate for him, feel Luke Pearce had a rough game and maybe let ego get to him. Hopefully not too biased of a view, Andy. Thanks for getting in touch, Andy. I know we've kind of started on the Luke Pearce thing there, but I think, again, you know, this isn't even from an Exeter point of view. I think that he was consistent and I think he was in charge and he let the players know he was in charge. And whilst he was in charge by making correct decisions. What I don't like is often people like Carly and Tempest who try
tempo.
And a tempo or oh, don't get me started. Who try and make decisions and they rule with that kind of a bit more of an iron fist, but they do it wrong. They get it wrong more often than not. Whereas Luke Pearce, he adapts his game to the situation. And I think the fact that Saracens Exeter Saracens game would have been, you know, part of his briefing would have been the fact that there are two teams, there's mutual dislike of each other, is going to be at boiling point. I think he chose to referee it along that harder line to keep it under control, which I think was entirely the right way of going about it. Ben, I think you probably disagree with that slightly.
Well, yeah, I do agree that Luke Pearce is a really good referee. I also think Barnes is a really good referee. But I didn't think he had his best game. I mean, there was one penalty decision against Itoje that was absolutely baffling. I thought it was a bit much, the marching him back, to be quite honest. I think the refs have been told to do it this season because I think there has been more of it. But I'm not so in favour of being completely unquestioning of the referee. I think as long as you're not calling him a dickhead, I think you should be able to ask. And I think, you know, an international ref isn't going to do it as much as the refs at our level, but we've probably all been on the end of a penalty against us, which was incorrect. And I think if that's the case, it's probably best to get into the ref's ear a little bit and let them know that it was quite borderline. And I thought from, I don't know what was said to him with the 20 meters incident, but it did just look like they were trying to question what had happened to the penalty that they should have had further up the pitch.
Well,
and I think,
but you shouldn't do that, should you?
Well, why
I mean, I know this is a bit rich coming from me, right?
Yeah.
And I will be the first to admit that I am probably not most referees' best friend in any sport that I've ever played. But like, you know what the laws say? You shouldn't be questioning or do it, you know, shouting at the referee in any way, shape or form. And if you get marched back 10 meters, it might make you think about your conduct next time, which it probably did.
Yeah. But I don't know. I just thought, I think, you know, if he called him stupid or sworn at him, then fair enough. But if he's just asking what happened to the penalty we should have had down there, I'm not sure that that's the most heinous crime that I've ever heard on a rugby pitch.
But again, we don't know what was said. And maybe it wasn't the first time that that type of incident had happened during the game and he'd let him get away with it.
I mean, Billy is a bit of a serial complainer, isn't he? It's not the first time he's had a penalty like that against him.
I'd go as far as to say he's a bit of a tit when he's on the field. He's got that I'm so hard done by, poor me, for want of a better word, why always me? Look about him. You can see on that video when he's been marched back, he's still looking around. You can still say that you can see that he's saying to himself, this guy's a fucking idiot and I'm right. Which I think is something that needs stamping out. And if Luke Pearce wants to march teams back 50 times in a row, good on him. I'm all for it.
I think the fact that it was those two teams, the first time that they'd met since Saracens had come back, and he knew it was going to be spicy, and he wanted to make sure that everybody knew he was in charge. And I think maybe that was the right way to do it, because it actually kept a lid on most of the most of potential flashpoints when they did occur,
which is a shame.
Well, is it though? Like, it kept the game going, and which is actually what I wanted to mention briefly about the game on Friday night, which was done just after 9:30 for the first time in God knows how long, because the game actually flowed, because it wasn't stop start, penalty, injury, penalty, trainers on, you know, it was nice. It was refreshing. But anyway, Exeter Saracens, two good tries by Exeter, Tom O'Flaherty, and then the second half try by Luke Cowan-Dickey. Exeter rewarded for scoring tries rather than, you know, and they kept Saracens out.
Bizarrely, both those tries came up straight after Saracens' best chances.
Yeah.
The two times Saracens looked like they were going to score. And I wonder if that kind of, they maybe just overcommitted slightly in the hopes of scoring. And because other than those two tries, Saracens' defence was all over Exeter.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it was almost as if they got a sniff of the line and just overcommitted a little bit, and then Exeter took advantage. You know, Cowan-Dickey and Slade both played really well, but I thought Atoje was just head and shoulders the best player on the pitch. He's just a nuisance. And I do think if that game had been 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, before Gray and Hill were available, I think it would have been different. I think Exeter just had enough.
I completely agree. And that's when I mentioned about the people coming back from injury. Gray and Hill, Cowan-Dickey, Joe Simmons starting at 10, Noel on the wing. They just kept like every sort of Saracens weapon. Saracens never got going really from an attacking point of view. Everything they tried with the ball in hand, Exeter shut down completely. And they did what Sale couldn't do the week before. I don't know what any of you guys thought about that.
Well, I didn't see the game, so I can't comment.
Yeah, I mean, it was...
It
was very much an arm wrestle, wasn't it? It was an entertaining arm wrestle, but it was still an arm wrestle.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. But it was gripping. And right to that final passage of play where Saracens were going for it. And, you know, just little errors, but forced by great defence. I thought Yanis Kirsten, when he came on, was massive. And whilst the two benches were relatively light, I thought, like in quality, you know, where you used to think both benches would have star-studded talent to come on, like neither of them were particularly strong. I mean, you look at Pifoletti, Swinson, Van Ziel, Morris, McFarland, Maui, Clary, Christie for Saracens. Then there was Capstick, Hendrickson, Kenny, Kirsten, Sam Maunder, Nixon, Skinner and Yendel, or Yeandal. good old Jack Yeandal for Exeter. Like,
I miss us getting names wrong.
None of those names are striking fear to anyone. Like, and so whilst the starting 15s for both teams were exceptional, like one of the biggest differences I thought was Yanis Kirsten coming off the bench, because they took Johnny Gray off in the second row, and they moved. They took Don Armand off for Kirsten, and he just added that massive amount of physicality that they needed at that time. And it was, you know, it was right after Cowan Dickey had scored, and it completely ballasted them. He took that next kick off. He then got a turnover, and it was Kirsten that got the turnover in the last minute to get to the ball back to kick it out as well. So yeah, I mean, they've definitely missed him. Phil, you got anything to add on this game?
Not specifically on this game, just, yeah, I think it's kind of stuff we've already covered in terms of it's going to end up being such a weird season. By the end of the season, we're going to flog the same lines about how Exeter and Saracens are not as good as they were a couple of years ago. And yes, things have clicked for various teams at various times, but I just, yeah, it's going to be a competitive season, which is good. There's some entertaining rugby being played out there, again, which is good. I just get really disappointed when I think that there's no relegation this season. It just pisses me off.
It just makes it all pretty irrelevant, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm good with it.
Yeah, I bet you are.
Why is that?
But you know what?
Bath of crap.
Getting relegated would be the best thing for Bath, potentially. To get relegated, start again, build up with keep as many of the players as they can, build a bit of culture around it, and come back better in 15 months' time, or 18 months' time, or whenever it would be.
It's just a real shame it wasn't Leicester.
Yeah. But, yeah, Leicester are the ones that disprove that theory, that it would have been good for them, because they're doing pretty well anyway.
Okay, talking of Leicester then, Welford Road, or the Mattioli Woods Welford Road Stadium on Sunday for the current league leaders against the Premiership champions from last season. Before we start rating Ben Youngs too highly, I mean, which isn't ever going to happen. Ben, what did you make of this one?
Well, I was really looking forward to this one because it was Stewart playing against Tyrone Green, and I was really looking forward to giving Eddie some grief because Eddie thinks Tyrone Green is better than Stewart.
I mean, that's...
But I thought Green...
Borderline moronic.
Yeah. Anyway, carry on. Probably better in the caravan. But I actually thought Green played quite well, other than one of those George Ford kicks that shall not be mentioned, which he completely missed. But
oh, mate, Austin Healey talking about those kicks. Like it's the first thing that's ever, like the first time it's ever been invented or happened. Oh,
the worst one, the worst thing Austin did in that whole game was when the Quinn's second row went to hoof the ball clear and completely got underneath it and it turned into a cross kick. And he was like, oh, look, he's looked up. Now, he might have looked up and seen the two players out there, but even if he had seen them, he was just going to belt it as far as he could and hope they could chase it. He wasn't trying to pick him out like Bowden Barrett, you know, from 40 metres away.
He hasn't dropped it onto his foot, has he? He's not dropped it onto his foot and nudged it into the corner. He's looked up to see where the touchline was.
Into Coventry. Oh, he's seen him. Yeah, he probably has seen him, but he was still trying to belt it. Anyway, but yeah, I thought Green was pretty decent under high ball. They put a lot of pressure on him in pretty bad conditions. But it was quite telling that Quinns didn't do the same to Stewart. They didn't even bother. So he was more like clearing up scraps. But I think I enjoyed this game more than you did, Russ. I thought it was a decent game. Agree with something Doug said in the chat that Kelly was probably the man of the match. Thought he was excellent in the centres for Leicester. And, you know, Ford is playing out of his skin, as we've said many times. It wasn't the best game that Smith's ever had in his life. He got yellow carded and just wasn't at his best. And I thought,
I mean, when you get handed off into next week by Ben Youngs,
yeah,
you know you're on to hide into nothing.
Yeah, and as a result, the two centres had very quiet games for Quinns. But I mean, I think we've mentioned Murley before as being a good player, but I didn't realise he was quite as big as he is and powerful. And although Liner scored a good try, he had a bit of a tough afternoon. But, you know, Leicester were the better team in that game and I think they deserve to win. I think if Quinns had snuck it, it would have been a little bit of a robbery, I think. The lad that came on, Chesham, looks a good player as well.
Is he in the back row?
Yeah, he looked pretty quick and showed some decent hands at times. So maybe they've got another one there. But
that's good news for everyone.
It was a very similar game to the Saracens one. And as you said, there's not quite as much of a grudge between these two teams. So it didn't have quite the edge, but they were both played in pretty difficult conditions. There was quite a lot of dick fingers going on by all four teams at times. And yeah, home side just snuck it on both occasions.
Douglas, did you manage to stay dry at the Matty Early Woods Welford Road yesterday?
Just about. Yeah, wore my Saints scarf, you know.
How did that go down?
Well, I had to do something to make anything in that ground mildly likable, so...
Well, it wasn't going to be you.
That was my effort. I thought that Quinns are playing like the team we think Quinns actually are. I think there's so much to be said for... momentum being the point of difference and a little bit of belief being the point of difference for teams in the Premiership. They, as in Harlequins, are a very good side with their tails up, but if you stick it on them, they don't like it. And I think that was evidenced yesterday. They didn't really have any answers for Leicester's aggression and defence. And I don't think they can overpower teams. So they were found. I mean, their scrum was quite surprising. I say that, but then their scrum yesterday was sort of dominant over a Leicester scrum that I thought would be the one that was going forward all the time. But as I said, I don't think they can cope with the physicality of teams like Leicester.
Ben, you mentioned Murley a minute ago, and he burst onto the scene a couple of years ago now, and he is an impressive individual. Do you think, and you could argue the same could be said for Green to a certain extent, it's obviously the way they're being coached or the way they're being told to play the game. But a couple of times, Murley got himself free down the wing. And instead of kicking into space behind, even just a little grubber and chasing through, because he is quick, he kind of backed himself to run through or round people. And he got tackled into touch a couple of times. Dan Kelly got across once, and we mentioned him. I thought he was excellent on the day. But just a utilization of space, and whether that's him not identifying it or whether he's just sort of been told not to do it. But like he had, who was directly opposite him? Potter? Was it Potter? And at one point he bounced off a Potter, went round the outside. And if he'd kicked to the corner, they would have gained quite a lot of territory, except he kept hold of it and then got bumped into touch. And it was just a bit, it seemed a bit naive. I don't know if either of you guys noticed that.
Yeah, I did notice that it's the one thing I know about rugby, that you don't try and go outside of a man with the touchline because it's an extra defender. So
what do you do instead, Doug? You just chip it.
Oh, you just chip it over the top of him, mate. Yeah.
Straight to him.
Doug's the wrong person to ask about chips, isn't he?
Well, I'd say Russ is the wrong person to ask about chips, mate. If I'm honest.
Absolute shambles.
my preference would always be to keep the ball in hand. But you're right. He needs to cut inside if he's going to do that. That might be because I'm Britain's slowest fullback, so chipping ahead's probably not playing to my skip my strength.
But if you've got support players as well, like you're going to pin teams down, and then you get the scrum, even if they win the line out and kick it back, and you then get a line out on halfway. As it transpired, he was giving away a line out on halfway ball back to the opposition, and it just doesn't really make any sense.
Maybe he can't kick.
I think it works back from the other side as well, in terms of probably both Murley and Green will have taken the ball and had multiple defenders in front of them and run at them and tried to run around them and tried to run through them. At times when a kick may have been a more sensible option to clear your lines or a pass in field. And I think it's more a matter that they've had it coached into them that if they lift their head and they fancy going for a run, then go for it. And the rest of the team will just have to deal with the consequences. As opposed to whatever you do, don't kick the ball. I think it's more go for a run, go for it. And it kind of comes back to that Green versus Stewart conversation. Yeah, Green is a better running fullback with the ball in his hands without a shadow of a doubt. But that doesn't mean that sometimes he doesn't run up blind alleys and cost you the ball and not make the right tactical decisions.
I don't know whether he is. I watch Freddie Stewart run with the ball in two hands and he identifies space. He takes contact. He, to me, runs more head up.
So
as in playing the game as he wants it to be played. Whereas Tyrone Green would be what I would call a head down runner. He is just gonna get his head down and run.
So stats wise, Tyrone Green has run 1,176 meters this season, which is the highest in the Premiership by quite some distance. Murley's about seventh on 640. Esther Hayes in 618, but obviously his yards are in a very different way. But actually, that's seriously impressive for Esther Hayes. Stewart doesn't even make the list, which bottoms out at 588. So Tyrone Green's gained at least double the number of metres that Stewart has.
Probably so, bearing in mind Stewart was not playing Premiership rugby for at least 5 weeks.
Correct. And also,
I just think he makes better tactical decisions, and sometimes that's kicking the ball, sometimes that's passing the ball.
And Green gets
the ball in his hand and he wants to run past people every time.
Exactly. And there's a time and a place for that.
Stewart's running at his support, whereas Green's more of a broken field runner who's just going to try and make something happen. Whereas Stewart is a classical fullback in that he's going to make a more sensible decision. Which is basically what Russ was trying to say. But yeah, that's
exactly what I was trying to say.
Not to say Green is not a good player, but
absolutely. But Stewart is better.
I think we're all on record, aren't we?
Yeah, oh yeah, 100%. And you know, you might hear or might not hear more about that later in the week. Right. Any other rugby related business that anybody wants to talk about? Anything going on? Any of you?
Oh, just
good win for Hornets.
Yeah, exactly. Great win for Hornets. Fantastic win. They went down to Plimstock and turned over the team that so far this season is the only team to have beaten Topsham in the league. One of their coaches afterwards said that the Hornets have got a team of absolute athletes who are well drilled, which doesn't sound like any Hornets team I've ever played in.
Certainly wasn't the Hornets team that I played in.
Noticeable that Russ wasn't on the team sheet this week.
Yeah, conspicuous by my absence. I'm still injured.
I mean, they've had a really interesting season. They got pretty badly beaten in five out of the first six games, drew down at Veal being their only points, and since then have won all but one.
Yeah. Since I made my return against Hale.
Since I got injured.
Wow. You know, the huge, two things aren't mutually exclusive.
Huge credit to Lee Pascoe, who came out of retirement, played one game at hooker, and then his next game at fullback.
Yeah.
That's so level eight.
And I think enjoyed the bus trip back quite a lot as well.
I think they all enjoyed the bus trip back, which is arguably the best bit. In fact, arguably about it. Right, let's get into some any other business. Douglas, any other business? Come back to me, mate.
Yeah, come back to me, mate.
Why do you always come to me first?
Do on purpose. Philip.
I took the boys down to Plymouth Pavilions last night to go and see Major Tim Peake, who did a little talk about his trip into space, showed some really interesting videos, some clips. The boys absolutely loved it, were completely enthralled by it. I thought Major Tim Peake was mailing it in a little bit, to be honest, and didn't seem entirely engaged with what he was presenting, but at £35 a head and a full pavilions, he can do what he likes, can't he? I would probably say if you're interested in it, I'd start with reading his book first. It was good fun nonetheless. Late night back for the kids, though.
Good. Ben.
I watched a programme on Netflix called Elves, which was Danish.
Is it a follow-up to Elf?
Kind of, yeah. It's basically the elves are like evil and a sort of terrorizing this village. It was quite short, and it was. I'm not making a recommendation here. All I can say is the main character, who was a teenage girl, was the most irritating character I've ever encountered on a television program. And by the end of it, both of us were encouraging the carnivorous elves to rip her to pieces.
Good. Doug, are you back now?
I haven't really got anything this week. Okay. Sorry, everyone.
That's fine. Fair enough.
Watch this space for some interesting things in the next couple of weeks. Ooh, or maybe just after Christmas. I've got some logs on fires that may interest everyone that listens to this podcast.
I think we should probably put the teasers earlier on in the pod because not many make it to the end.
Oh, they're all still listening. I will end this off. I'm 2/3 of the way through 14 Peaks. What a fucking guy that is, by the way.
You actually watched a recommendation of mine?
Of course I have. Watch all your recommendations.
Do then. You bollocks?
Don't always agree with them, but I always watch them. But what an amazing, amazing individual. Quite incredible.
Yeah.
The next thing I'm going to suggest is the Ashes start tomorrow night. Is it tomorrow night? I'm beyond excited. It's going to be incredible. Can't wait. But while we're talking cricket, there is a New Zealand spinner, Indian-born New Zealand spinner, Ajaz Patel, who took 10 wickets in an innings earlier on this week. And he single-handedly bowled India out for about 360, only for New Zealand to get bowled out for 62 in their first innings. But I think he's the third or fourth player in Test match history to take 10 wickets in an innings, which is quite an incredible feat. So fair play, old Ajaz. In his home, in the city where he was born, taking 10 wickets for New Zealand against India. So
fair play. It was at the Wankhede, wasn't it?
It was at the Wankhede, not to be confused with Timmy Mallett.
What did he get in the 62?
Hold on, and I will tell you. Analysis, 62 all out. And he picked up 4 wickets in the second innings as they were declared. He was naught not out for one ball, batting at 11. And in India's second innings, he picked up 4 for 106. So his match figures were 14 for 125 from quite a lot of overs, from about 67 overs.
And a batting average of infinity.
Yes, absolutely. So, but yeah, I'm excited about the Ashes starting. I can't wait to not put one up the Aussies. So there you go. Right, let's go. We might be back next week. We might do a punch and chat or something next week. We might do something different this week because it's European rugby and not many people really give a shit. Some people do, but we'll see. We might do something different next week. But other than that, we will see you all very soon and listen out for some other crazy stuff. Make sure you listen to Rugby Round and Banter this week, everybody. Eddie has got some pretty special stuff planned, apparently. I don't know what that is. So I will speak to you all very soon. Go well.
Sports Social Podcast Network.